Understand that we have some folks in Zoom that don't work for Parliament, so I'll just take a moment to introduce myself. My name is João. I work with Teresa in preparing the parliamentary dimension of the Portuguese presidency. I'm also an advisor to the Committee on Foreign Affairs and Portuguese Communities. That being said, we do have a full day ahead of us with five sessions planned for on a variety of topics, including EU governance, migration, external relations, and the CFSP. We are a bit behind schedule, so I'll just do a couple of quick reminders. The presentations were structured to take around 1 hour and 15 minutes, giving us about 15 minutes for Q&A. If you are in the room and wish to ask a question, please do so by raising your hand and we'll give you the floor. If you are with us remotely, please use the raise hand function in Zoom and or type in your questions in the chat window. Nora will do us the courtesy of relaying them to the presenters, to the speakers. Again, obviously, please write your questions in English. I think we can begin our first session. I'll let Edward get a word in before we start.
Thank you very much, João. I won't add anything except to say hello again to Diane, whom we had the pleasure of hearing yesterday. Now we see her in an even bigger version, to carry on developing two dimensions of our discussion, I think. First of all, the substantive agenda. EMU economic governance is an important part of the EU's evolution. There are important challenges, big new objectives being put on the table. We look forward to hearing the high points that need to be taken into account, the kind of things that are probably coming your way. And secondly, to carry on thinking about the forms of interparliamentary cooperation around this, which will be of particular priority, of course, for the Portuguese Parliament in the coming 6 months. So without any further, as you've just heard, look forward to Diane for the next hour and a quarter or so with the pauses, and we hope to collect good questions and look forward to the discussion. So thank you very much. Diane, over to you.
Yeah, good morning, everyone, also from me, and it's a pleasure to be with you this morning again. Sorry I'm not in Lisbon, but I look very much forward to the discussion, which, as has just been said, will happen in two modalities. First, I will pause after certain parts of my presentation, and then I hope that we have a Q&A session at the end of the presentation. In light of the time, I will start immediately and share my screen with you so that you can see the presentation. So okay, that should hopefully work. Yes, I see Nora is nodding, so there we are. So basically, what I'm going to do in this 1.5 hour, 1.5 and 15 minutes, is have a brief introduction about EMU. So what is EMU? I think the discussions you had and the presentations you had yesterday already paved the way to this. And it was already highlighted, for instance, that the issue of competence of the European Union is of particular importance in this policy area. So this is what I'm going to do in the first part. Then I'm going to look at specifically Parliament's role in this policy field. And in this, I will look at how they can collectively participate in this policy area. And then individually, so individual member states in the European semester, for instance. And then, as Edward was just anticipating, what I will try and do is highlight what it is that you can expect in the coming months during the Portuguese presidency and how this is going to change the EMU architecture as a whole and specifically Parliament's participation. So I think what you need to bear in mind when we discuss about EMU is the fact that EMU, so Economic and Monetary Union, is in fact composed of very different components, not only in terms of what they affect, so substantively, but also in terms of the type of competences that have been transferred to the Union. So you heard yesterday that there are basically three guiding principles for EU action. So in Article 5 of the Treaty on the Functioning, of the European Union, you have the principle of conferral. So the EU may only act if it has been given the competence. Then proportionality, so you, the use action should not be going beyond what is necessary for a specific aim to be achieved. And then the principle of subsidiarity, which means that in areas of shared competence, the EU should only act if member states may not sufficiently reach the objectives that has been defined. And on the other hand, at the same time, the Union can bring value by acting at European level. So these are the guiding principles, and eventually, depending on the area we're looking at in the Economic and Monetary Union, it will guide how much the European Union can or should be doing. And as I'm going to highlight, there's been discussions as to whether, for instance, the coordination procedures that take place in the framework of the European semester may have gone a little bit beyond what was foreseen by the treaties. In any event, means of starting this presentation and setting the background, I have listed for you here basically the different areas that compose the economic and monetary union. So on the one hand, you have this coordination of economic policy between member states, so sole cooperation, coordination and not further harmonization at the EU level. So economic policymaking, in other words, remains a member state competence. Then you have the same for fiscal policies, so coordination. But you have in this area the limits on government debt and deficits. So in other words, the Stability and Growth Pact and the 3% and 60% rule that I'm sure you're all aware of. Then next to this for your area, member states, you have the monetary policy that has been completely attributed to the European Central Bank. And there, basically, we have the so-called euro system in which the European Central Bank, together with the governors of the national central banks, are going to define the monetary policy for the euro area. So that's been also a key aspect, and I'm sure you've all heard the discussions in Germany around the Weiss decision of the Bundesverfassungsgericht, and there has been a similar response of the ECB to the pandemic crisis. So you can expect that this is definitely going to be on the table again. Then there are certain rules in terms of financial supervision for euro area member states, or for banking union in member states, better said, and I'll delve into this in a moment. And finally, we have the single currency and the euro area. So as you can see, a mix of different policy areas coming together in the economic and monetary union with very distinct competences being attributed to the European Union. Now, another aspect that I would like to highlight to you this morning is the fact that with the great financial crisis, so with the 2008 crisis, basically we've had very important changes. So we had the European semester, which, you've heard a lot about yesterday, but I will look at it in this hour and a half from really this EMU perspective and not so much from the social aspects, etc. So that was introduced 10 years ago in 2010 by the European Commission. And basically you have these different aspects and different faces to it. So one is mainly taking part at EU level with the overall stance that is being offered on the growth within the European Union, country-specific recommendations being addressed to the member states, etc. And then, on the other hand, the other half of the year, it's on the member states to do their work, so to say, in approving national budgets, etc. So you have those two national and European components. Another thing to bear in mind when talking about the European semester is that the rules that apply to euro area, so that's what EA stands for, euro area in this presentation, differ depending on Or basically based on the fact that euro area member states economies are much more intertwined than non-euro area member states. And the rationale basically for those more stringent rules for euro area member states is the fact that if you share a common currency, then arguably your economies must be better coordinated. Then in terms of what happened with the crisis, so we had the introduction of the six-pack and the two-pack of legislation, with the two-pack being only applicable to euro area member states. And the important thing to bear in mind here is that these two sets of pieces of legislation are now undergoing a review. So this is what this will probably be continued. And there have been discussions going on prior to the pandemic crisis as to how this European semester should be reshaped. Now, what is also important to bear in mind here is that so far, so in the documents that were originally published by the Commission, there was no question about the way the European semester, the premises of the European semester, that were functioning. In a sense, the idea to have sanctions or the idea of the monitoring and the way in which decision-making is made with a very important role being attributed to the European Commission following the adoption of the six-pack and the two-pack has not been really questioned. So some academics, for instance, have discussed this question of institutional balance with the Commission going beyond its role of sole technocratic monitoring and the councils of the member states having to achieve a qualified majority with a view to rejecting what the Commission is proposing. But we may go back to this in the discussion, but what I think is important is the fact that this review was already ongoing and, of course, is going to be impacted by the measures that have been adopted in response to the COVID crisis, because as you heard yesterday, the European semester is going to be one of the channels of monitoring through which the recovery facility is going to be implemented. Now, in terms of what the issues with the European semester are or what should be borne in mind when talking about this review and a potential reform to the European semester, I think one thing that is clear is its complexity with all those different procedures and the way in which the different decisions are made, etc. There has been an issue of a lack of ownership. So in other words, there has been a widespread feeling that this procedure is taking place in Brussels and it's really far away from member states and their concerns, and there has been it hasn't been felt really in several member states as something that is beneficial to all, or really something that it has been at least shaped by national institutions. And one should bear in mind when saying this that the European Parliament's involvement and the national parliament's involvement, at least as foreseen at the European level, is fairly limited. And now the last point that is also has been an issue is that there are those country-specific recommendations, and 10 years after the introduction of the European semester, it is quite clear that the compliance has been fairly low. So there are numerous of those recommendations are only partially followed by the member states later on, leading to a yearly conclusion that eventually they have not been fulfilled. So thereby raising the importance of those country specific recommendations. Another point to bear in mind when talking about the economic and monetary union is also the very wide variety of institutions that are being involved in this framework. So, in other words, it's not only the number of institutions that matters, but it's also their nature. So you have an intertwinement between formal institutions, so institutions that are recognized in the treaties, and also informal forums, primarily the Eurogroup and the Euro area, the Euro Summit, excuse me. So here I have listed the list of institutions that are being involved. So as you can see, it's well, literally all institutions, so European Council and this Euro Summit, so basically which brings the heads of states and governments from Euro area member states together in an informal setting. And the existence of this Euro Summit was recognized in an international treaty, in the fiscal compact. Then we have the Council, which plays a key role, and next to it, the Eurogroup, which is also, the members of the Eurogroup also are those who make the decisions in the framework of the ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, which is an intergovernmental treaty next to the EU treaties that will provide support to member states in difficulty. And a novelty with Brexit was that the Eurogroup was not only taking place among ministers from Euro area member states, but also of the EU27. So all the member states, so to say, outside of the UK started to meet together in this informal forum, so the so-called inclusive format. And it's noteworthy that despite Brexit having now happened, this informal forum, which eventually brings together all the member states, has survived next to the formal economic configuration of the Council, which raises very important questions of transparency, but also accountability, because many parliaments do not have tools developed to monitor what is going on in the Eurogroup, and also the institution, the obligations that rest on the Eurogroup in terms of transparency, access to documents, etc., are lower than the ones that rest on the normal Council, the EU institutions, so to say. Then we also have the European Commission, which, as you heard already yesterday, also plays a very important role in the monitoring and the drafting of Council recommendations, etc., with the issue I've just mentioned of a dual role, or perhaps in view of some a role that goes beyond what it should be exercising. The European Central Bank, which is supportive of the euro area economy by means of its monetary policy, but that has also been involved in other settings, such as the Troika at the peak of the crisis, and etc. So its role goes beyond the sole monetary policy for the euro area. The European Parliament, and finally member states. So member states, as in national governments and national parliaments, for instance, when approving the budget. So I think this is really clear that it's a very complex panorama. And that means that eventually the participation of national parliaments is particularly difficult. First, because of these different types of competencies I was mentioning at the beginning, we have very different decision procedures that exist in parallel. We have also this idea of informality. I've just told you about the Eurogroup. Same applies for the Euro Summit. So it makes it even more complex to monitor and scrutinize what is going on. We also have this question of the duality between Euro area member states and non-Euro area member states. The coexistence of EU law proper, which will then be subject to the review of the Court of Justice, and in which, to a certain extent, the European Parliament is going to be involved, etc. Whereas we have next to this, as a result of the Great Financial Crisis, a series of intergovernmental agreements. So the Fiscal Compact, the ESM Treaty, the European Stability and Mechanism Treaty for Member States in Difficulties, are the main intergovernmental treaties that exist and that are then submitted to other means of participation for national parliaments. Another point that makes this scrutiny particularly difficult is also the independence of the ECB. So I've just mentioned earlier the vice judgment of the Bundesverfassungsgericht, and that has led to tension in the sense that from the moment onwards that the monetary policy that is being pursued by the European Central Bank is perceived as having too much an impact on the economic policy and not only or not so sufficiently on monetary policy, then there you see this issue of competencies I was telling you about arising again. And then the last point I would like to mention is that it is clear that in view of the importance of the of this policy field, many times whenever anything is decided with regards to the economic and monetary union, it's being done under a sense of urgency. You will all remember, for instance, the whole summits that we had during the pandemic, but also during the great financial crisis, whereby our heads of state and government were coming in the form of the European Council every so often. So this is really making it more difficult to have a proper, adequate parliamentary control, in my view. Now, as closing this introduction, I would like to show you briefly a few of these institutional novelties that have arisen as a result of the great financial crisis. This is mostly for your reference, but of course, as I said before, I will open the floor for any questions or remark before I delve into parliamentary participation. So if anything is unclear, just use the chat or raise your hands in the room, and I'm sure Edward and Teresa will rein my attention to you. So I've just told you that the architecture of the economic and monetary union was particularly affected as a result of the great financial crisis that struck Europe around 10 years ago. And one of those novelties is, for instance, this European system of financial supervision. So you may have you may be familiar with what, for instance, the European Banking Authority is doing. So this is one of those agencies that has been now created with a view to making sure that our financial system within the European Union is sufficiently sound. So we have now three European agencies, which you heard about yesterday, which are those independent bodies, independent and technical bodies that are being set and are being basically given a task to implement in a specific policy area upon delegation by the European Commission. And this system very much relies still, and I think this is of key importance to Parliament, on so-called national competent authorities, which you have at the bottom of this house. So in other words, there may still be certain means to gain information, at least for national parliaments, by liaising with the corresponding national authority. And exactly the same applies to the banking union. So as part of the novelties that were introduced after the great financial crisis, we had a banking union being created within the European Union in 2012. The banking union, as you can see on this slide, is composed of three pillars. The first one being banking supervision. So basically, banks are being supervised by primarily the European Central Bank, but also national competent authorities, which may be the central bank, but in some member states it's not. And they are going to check basically that the banks are not at risk of failing. If that does happen, we have a second pillar that will then be there for the resolution of banks. So the whole idea behind the introduction of the banking union was to avoid member states having to recapitalize banks or to save banks, so to say, with public money. So we now have a much more detailed and much closer examination of what banks, financial institutions are doing within the banking union. The third pillar, which is the one that is incomplete on your picture, is supposed to be for deposit insurance, but this is still under negotiation, and that's actually one of the files that may be on your agenda during the Portuguese presidency, the completion of the banking union. But basically here, this banking union project brings together euro area member states so far. So you have the possibility for non-euro area member states to voluntarily subscribe to the banking union. And actually two of them have now shown interest in doing so in the process of later on adopting the euro. These are Bulgaria and Croatia. And they have started the procedure to do so. And this complex system of the banking union rests upon a supranational supervision or resolution, which is on the one hand headed by the European Central Bank in the area of supervision and by an agency, another agency, the Single Resolution Board in the case of resolution. But in this system, national authorities really play a key role, and they will, for instance, in the supervision of the most important banks of the banking union, participate in joint teams with the European Central Bank. So this is really a different structure, in other words, from the one that we have in the monetary union, whereby the European Central Bank makes a decision for the whole of the euro area and everything is centralized in Frankfurt. There in the banking union, yes, you have supervision being exercised by the European Central Bank, but national competent authorities really play a key role, and you have a division of competences in this area of banking supervision. A last slide to show to you how complex the whole system has become, and I will not delve into the details of this, but I just wanted to emphasize this point because I think it really makes accountability and control more difficult. So I've just told you that as part of the reforms that were adopted to counter the great financial crisis, we have had the creation of this European system of financial supervision with those three agencies, the European Banking Authority, the Supervisory Authority for Markets, the ESMA, and the EIOPA for Insurances. So these are the three agencies you see in the middle of the slide. But there in the European Banking Authority, you also have the participation of the European Central Bank in the supervisory capacity. That system is then also composed of the European Systemic Risk Board, the ESRB, which you see on the top right corner, which is then in turn chaired by the president of the European Central Bank. And then the ECB itself, the European Central Bank itself, is now divided in two areas, one that is in charge of the monetary policy and the other one that is in charge of banking supervision. So you see that this is a very complex system, and I've just taken the ECB as an example to show to you that, for instance, when it's called upon to come before the European Parliament, it will come in very different capacities before parliamentarians. So we can discuss if you have any questions or specifics of this architecture, but I think this was there for you to get an idea of how complex this whole system has become. And with this, I would actually now turn to parliamentary participation in EMU, but I'd like to take any questions or comments you may have before that.
I don't know, Bruno, do you want to comment now or Etienne? I guess we don't have any questions. Bruno, you need to turn on your mic. I'm sorry, Nora, can you see if Bruno has rights to...
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Now we can, yes.
Yeah?
Yes, we can hear you.
I think that the best is yet to come, so I'll let Diane... Good morning, everyone, sorry. I will let Diane go until the end, and I will step in at the very end, if it's okay with you.
Yeah, sure. Were there any other questions?
We also have someone else. Yes, Angela, please.
Hello, good morning. My name is Angela, and I'm in... Can you hear me now?
Yes,
yeah?
We can.
I'm working at budget committee, and yes, I'm working at the budget committee, and also a focal point for the European semester here in the Portuguese Parliament. And I could say something about this lack of ownership and lack of Parliament involvement, because we are involved in a Parliament European project coordinated by eGov, which is dedicated to analyze this problem. And I would like maybe to... This is a project with the Portuguese Parliament along with other national parliaments, European parliaments, and maybe I could share some of the Portuguese Parliament experience in this concern. I would say that the focus of the scrutiny in our Parliament in this regard, the European semester cycle, is focused on the debate on stability program and national program, national reform program. That's the high point, the highlight of our scrutiny and the most important moment for scrutiny in our Parliament. And this debate occurs both in the plenary session and in our committee, the budget committee. But it is only a debate. Okay, so this debate means that no opinion is issued about these documents. Of course, you can, and it happened in the past that a political group may present a proposal, a resolution proposal, to say something about these documents, to say we don't agree on this or that, but, and it did happen once or twice in this Parliament. This resolution proposal was voted, but it didn't pass. Again, if it did, even if it did, it doesn't mean much. It just means that you give a recommendation to the government in these matters. So our participation, our involvement, as well as other parliaments, is low. Another example would be maybe the draft budget plan. It's a good example, I think, because this draft plan was presented by the government, and again, presented, not submitted, okay? Was presented two or three times in this Parliament, mainly during the Troika period, and also in the last budget process for 2020. It was presented, but, and this is important, it was firstly submitted to the European Commission and then, secondly, to the Parliament. And this gives you and gives us an idea of how twisted the process is. But I have to say also that the MPs, most of the time, they didn't ask for the draft plan. So I don't know if it's lack of interest. It's challenging to understand why does it happen, also from the MP's part. Thank you very much.
All right. I think we'll let Diane continue, and we'll save Bruno's comments for Diane.
Okay, no, thank you very much for this, these insightful comments from your Portuguese experience, which indeed mirror what is going on in other parliaments. But indeed, let's look at the theory and what parliaments could be doing, and then maybe we go back to, how this could potentially be improved or what could be done. So to this end, what I would like to do, as I anticipated before, is to discuss what is Parliament's role in the economic and monetary union at present. And first, I would like to discuss the issue of the collective participation of Parliaments. And then, indeed, what has just been touched upon, the question of the individual participation of Parliaments. So in terms of the collective participation of parliaments, so we heard yesterday, we have in the treaty two legal bases for interparliamentary cooperation. So we have basically in Article 12 that regards national parliaments, which are called upon to contribute actively to the good functioning of the European Union since the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty by means inter alia of interparliamentary cooperation. And that is later on developed in the protocol annexed to the treaty that is dedicated to national parliaments in the European Union. And there you have two different articles, 9 and 10, that regards interparliamentary cooperation on the one hand in the framework of COSAC. I already told you about COSAC yesterday. It's this interparliamentary conference that was created 31 years ago with a view to bringing together the different European affairs committees, so the non-sectoral committees of national parliaments. And then you have the a general possibility to promote interparliamentary cooperation. Interparliamentary cooperation in the framework of the Economic and Monetary Union, so sector-specific interparliamentary cooperation, has been really a recent development that is actually anchored outside of the EU treaty framework in the fiscal compact. So you may have heard or you may come across in the future with the terminology of Article 13 conference in place of this stability and economic convergence governance conference that SECG that I have on the slides. And that's because the Article 13 of the fiscal compact actually mentions this idea of interparliamentary cooperation. The fiscal compact was approved at the peak of the crisis when the previous crisis, when it proved impossible to revise the EU treaties because of the British opposition to anchor inter alia a golden rule, so the rule that the budget should be in balance in the member states in the European treaties. So that's why member states resorted to an intergovernmental treaty outside of the framework of EU law. And basically in that Article 13 of the fiscal compact, you have the idea that national parliaments and European Parliament and the European Parliament should cooperate. Now, I think it's fair to say that the start of this interparliamentary conference was particularly bumpy. There were no agreements that could be found in terms of even the number of delegates that each of the national parliaments should be sending. So whereas you might remember I told you yesterday that in the framework of COSAC, each of the national parliaments is going to send six representatives. In other interparliamentary conferences, you have other numbers. But in the framework of this Article 13 conference, well, there was no agreement. It's also important to say that not all EU member states are a party to this fiscal compact, and still all of them are represented. So it's not only euro area, it's an EU-wide initiative. And also it's fair to say that whereas in other policy areas, the European Parliament is very much involved and has an active role, in that policy area, it has, well, much less to say. And the reason for this is also that, well, economic and fiscal policies are meant to be coordinated at the EU level. And in the framework of the semester, the role of the European Parliament itself is limited. And therefore, there has been a feeling, which, again, if you may remember what I explained yesterday, the perception varies across member states, and also the importance and the aim of this interparliamentary cooperation varies among the different national parliaments. But some perceived the European Parliament as trying to gain power in the framework of this interparliamentary conference that it didn't have. There are a lot of underlying tensions in the framework of this conference. And you heard yesterday as well that the European Parliament has this initiative that is called the European Parliamentary Week, which started in 2011. And basically, in that framework, the European Parliament is inviting national parliaments to Brussels to have debates. And originally, this meeting was relatively long. So you had this European Parliamentary Week and also the first meeting of this Article 13 conference taking place one after the other. And now even the length of the meeting has been reduced, and there have been issues. I was telling you before that there are questions in terms of formats or in terms of how to tackle the need to have a debate and to allow parliamentarians to really express themselves and discuss. That has been also visible in this policy area. So this European Parliamentary Week is the first meeting of the two meetings that I organize every year in the framework of the Article 13 conference. Always takes place in Brussels, and then during the second half of the year you have another meeting in whose framework the presidency parliament potentially plays a bigger role, only be it because it's not organized in the framework of the European Parliamentary Week in Brussels. So that's what I meant here on the slide with several weaknesses that have been, well, questions of format and also the length and other issues that have arisen. And like I said yesterday, there are certain issues which, in my view, have not been touched upon, such as the banking union, that would deserve to be discussed in that framework. Next to this, and the eGov unit has just been mentioned, so the eGov unit is a support unit of the European Parliament that basically prepares very useful briefings and fosters also cooperation with national parliaments inter alia at staff level. So you have this initiative that was launched a few years ago to bring together staff from national parliaments and the European Parliament to discuss questions. And basically, I put here on this slide what the eGov unit defines as the goal of this initiative, which is basically to strengthen cooperation and better understanding among EU national parliaments and the European Parliament administrations of the different steps and tools of the European semester. So the European semester being a very complex procedure in whose framework, well, parliaments have little time, and it was already highlighted as an issue yesterday. Well, now you have those initiatives, which, in my understanding, is quite helpful to share information and best practices. Because one key aspect of interparliamentary cooperation is indeed to share information and learn from one another. And there have been examples of spillover whereby a national parliament has copied and adapted a procedure that was existing in another national parliament, or for instance, national parliaments have benefited from the extra information to which the European Parliament has access, and they don't have access at national level. Because another point to bear in mind, perhaps, is the fact that national parliaments will depend on the national rules in terms of access to information, and not all of them are on an equal footing in this regard. So some of them have more access than others. But that's also one of the key, added value of interparliamentary cooperation. But specifically with regard to staff-to-staff cooperation, it's also means to understand the different concepts that are behind the economic surveillance to be pursued within the framework of the European semester. I think I would then go to the individual the individual participation in EMU, but I would like to also again open the floor if there are any questions or remarks on collective participation in EMU.
I think in the chat, there are no questions, but I would like to remind people on Zoom that they're welcome to send anything in the chat if they have any questions with regards to the next upcoming points.
Thank you, Nora. We do have some people who wish to take the floor, but at the end of the presentation, or no? So perhaps, yeah. This is Christina, our head of unit for the committees division.
Okay. Good morning. I would first of all thank you very much for your presentation. I would just like to share my experience as a former representative that Article 13's conference is, in spite of all you were talking about, there are some questions of organization or some questions about the conference and the European week, European Parliamentary Week. But in spite of all the problems, it is one of the moments at the Portuguese Parliament where the semester is looked at. And Angela was telling that, and she's right, that the attention that is drawn to the question here is not always the one we should have. But regarding this cooperation, our MPs always participate with a high level of participation. They are usually speakers in the conferences, in the panels, and they really prepare for it. And also regarding the staff-to-staff meetings with EGOV, Angela was our colleague, was there in the European Parliament also in a long-term, not internship, but had an experience during 2 weeks in order to bring capacity to our Parliament. So both Angela and Bruno, also our current representative, participate also actively. So I think this is a really one of the examples where interparliamentary cooperation is meaningful and makes some difference in the way we look at some European issues. And I think it is important to stress it, and I really hope that after the presidency or during the presidency this awareness raises even more, and that when we have another discussion about European semester or about parliamentary participation in the European semester, that we can share a better experience, an even better experience also internally, which is what we were going to address now. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think it was important to stress that this is one of the cases where our work is really meaningful. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for this insight. And I think it, again, illustrates that, you know, depending on who the actors are who are involved, the vision is different. And indeed, I mean, there you were mentioning that the Portuguese Parliament is very much represented in those instances. At the same time, there are other parliaments that are much less represented and send fewer MPs. So I think, yeah, maybe one thing to think about is, yeah, how to make this attractive for everyone and to ensure this is of interest to all parliaments. I think perhaps one idea would be to have questionnaires like you would have in the framework of COSAC or other, practical things that could be put in place, but maybe that's the point for later. Also, once you have heard Bruno's experience, who's also seeing it from inside. So with this, I would go again to the individual participation of national parliaments in the framework of the European semester, on which we already heard very interesting, information from the Portuguese Parliament. And before I delve into this, I think it's important to stress that the European semester does not take place in isolation. So it's not only the specific means of scrutiny that are being designed for the participation of parliaments in the framework of the European semester that can be used, but it's also all those that exist in other areas or generally for the participation in EU affairs that could potentially be of relevance. And that means, for instance, that the Eurogroup it's not only active when it's called to be involved in the European semester, or the same goes for the European Council. You may have, and this is not the case of all national parliaments, but specific scrutiny mechanisms for those forums that, of course, you can then use for participation or scrutiny of the European semester. And if we look specifically at those European semester mechanisms, well, I think it's a key power for national parliaments, so their power of the purse that is being affected by the procedure, this coordination procedure within the European semester, which, well, coordination is perhaps a too weak word in view of the consequences of the decisions or the recommendations that are made within the framework of the European semester. And what I mentioned yesterday as well is the fact that we still have a differentiated picture of reality across member states, in the sense that whereas in some national parliaments it has been, well, a means to restrict their budgetary power, in others it has been found as a ground through which national parliaments were able to reinforce their power in the budgetary procedure, where we see a tendency in many member states basically for the government to take a lead on budgetary procedures for different reasons. And this has been, for instance, in my own member states now with the COVID crisis, there has been a discussion in the past week in terms of the parliament's reduced possibility to discuss and debate the budget in COVID times, and et cetera. So these are elements that may have led national parliaments to have fewer budgetary powers in the past, and some of them have used the European semester to try and regain this lost power in the budgetary area. Apologies for this. Okay. However, and this is, I think, clear by now after we heard the discussions yesterday, much of the possibilities for national parliaments to participate in the European semester will eventually depend on what is being adopted at national level. So we have this clear division between what is being fixed by the treaties, and that's not only applicable to the Economic and Monetary Union, but the European norms fix a minimum of parliamentary involvement, and this is something that has been changing over time. So whereas we had no recognition of national parliaments' importance in the original treaties, we see that with the Treaty of Maastricht and the inclusion of principles such as the principle of subsidiarity, progressively, we have a recognition of the importance of national parliaments, and we now have, as you heard yesterday, the definition of democracy within the European Union, a specific article dedicated to national parliaments' participation in the European Union. But besides this minimum standard that is being guaranteed to them in terms of receiving documents and being able to scrutinize the respect of the principle of subsidiarity, many of the procedures in terms of, like I said before, the scrutiny of the representative in the council or in the Eurogroup, of the possibility to participate or to scrutinize what is going on in the framework of the European stability mechanism, eventually will depend on what is being approved at national level. And that's why you have so many differences across national parliaments. And again, that's also one of the reasons that explains the different understanding, and if also the different perception of the importance of interparliamentary participation. So, for instance, if you think of the Finnish parliament, which has very strong rights at national level, it doesn't feel it needs to participate in the framework of the subsidiarity check because it can influence its government. So just by means of example and the background, that eventually the participation in the European semester as well will depend heavily on what is being adopted at national level, and that's why we have the different the many differences. So we heard the illustration before that the plans are being sent to the Commission before they are being discussed in Parliament, and this is not only a case of Portugal. So whereas in other parliaments you may have an earlier involvement of Parliament. And I think one point of attention is that the European semester will become even more important in the Union post-COVID, so it will become a very important tool for the implementation of the recovery facility, and therefore perhaps parliamentary participation in the framework of the European semester should be even stronger than it has been before. With this, I would like also specifically to highlight a procedure which was introduced with the creation of the banking union and which has so far not really attracted a lot of, or not really been used by many national parliaments. And it's the possibility that is being guaranteed to them both in the framework of the single supervisory mechanism. So this mechanism that is there for the supervision of financial institutions and is being headed by the European Central Bank that I told you about before. And a similar one exists with regards to the single resolution board, so this agency that is there for the resolution of banks. And these are procedures that are key because eventually they will decide on the life of or death of the banks. So that's really something that is there politically very relevant, but also economically for a member state's economy can have a very strong impact. And in that regard, the both of the regulations, the both of the EU norms that establish the supervision and the resolution framework have foreseen the possibility for national parliaments to directly interact with the EU institution or body that is responsible for the specific procedure. And that's basically what you have here. So you have a very original accountability framework that has been designed for the control of the ECB in a supervisory capacity, whereby basically the national parliaments can enter in a direct relationship with the ECB. And the reason for this is that basically there is a potential impact of the supervisory measures on public finances, credit institutions, customers and employees, and the markets in the participating member states. So what I have just told you before, that in view of this important impact of the member states, there is a possibility for national parliaments to organize hearings. They can ask questions to the European Central Bank, and they will receive, they will receive the SSM annual report, and they will have face-to-face exchanges of views with the ECB representative and the national representative of the national competent authority. So you have this direct possibility to ask questions and to gain information from both the ECB and the national competent authority, which, as I said, has not been really used so far. So it's been around two hearings on average that have been organized between the ECB and national parliaments in this supervisory capacity. There are certain risks. So on the one hand, I think it's a very important means for national parliaments to participate, and in view of the importance of the decisions that are being taken in this framework, and while you know firsthand experience of the importance of resolution decisions, for instance, and so there is a broad justification. At the same time, there is also a risk that by having this debate in the national arena, you will renationalize the debate. So, and the issue there is that the board member that, so the supervisory board member that will come to Parliament needs to also still defend the interest of the union as a whole. It's also important to mention that even if in the monetary policy aspect, the the European Central Bank is under no obligation to go to national parliaments. So the accountability of the European Central Bank in its monetary policy function for the euro area is there to go to the European Parliament. It's not accountable to national parliaments. And that's, well, because of the transmission of the conferral of the power in monetary policy area to the European Central Bank. However, the previous president of the European Central Bank has been committed to go to national parliaments when being invited to do so. So we can also discuss this if you have any specific interest. But I think it's important to bear in mind also that certain type of exchanges or relationships may develop on an informal basis. So here I have the information on the single resolution board, but I think I've summarized essentially what is important here, that you also have this possibility to have direct exchanges, and you will have the slides for your easy reference for at a later point. I think in the interest of time, I should move on to what is awaiting the European Union in the coming months. But before I do this, I would again like to invite any questions or comments that you may have.
I think you can go ahead, Anne.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so like I said before, so what I would like to discuss first of all are what are the current topics in the area of economic and monetary union that are being discussed at the European level. And as you can see from the slide, it's a whole list of things that are currently being under discussion at the EU level and in very many different areas. So first off, we are still facing the review of the six-pack and two-pack of legislation that I mentioned at the very beginning. So this was a procedure that was already started prior to the pandemic and will continue and will probably become even more relevant given the use of the European semester for other instruments. We also have the ongoing question of the completion of the banking union and this third pillar I was telling you about at the beginning that basically had been stalled after arguably after the sense of urgency of the previous crisis disappeared and there hadn't been much progress in this sense, and now this is again on the EU's agenda. And the same, for the capital markets union, so the idea that we should really have a free, an internal market within which capitals can circulate freely, which has been an objective of the treaties ever since we've had the four freedoms, but is still not fully realized at this point. And the Commission now presented again a document in this sense last week. So this is something that is high on the political agenda. Another point that has been high on the political agenda is the question of the reform of the European Stability Mechanism Treaty. So this treaty that was approved at the peak of the crisis to guarantee the possibility to have a permanent mechanism to help economic stability within the euro area, and that's basically what will help member states in difficulty. There had been reforms with different aspects, inter alia accountability, because as I told you before, its existence outside of the EU treaty framework makes that the usual rules that are applied that are applicable in terms of accountability are not applicable to the ESM, even though there are other indirect means of control, for instance, because of the identical of the Eurogroup and the board of the ESM. But still, this is one of the discussion points that had been ongoing with the ESM, and then the reform procedure was stalled, and now, it will be an important point also arguably because of the use of the ESM to provide support to member states in response to the pandemic, so the pandemic credit line. Then there are also elements that have been put in place to directly or as immediate responses to the economic downturn that has been provoked by the pandemic, and that's SURE, which is one instrument that will help member states support short-term support to the market. So basically, if you have schemes that will replace the salaries of workers, and then member states will start to implement those, and then can be receiving support of the EU to maintain those schemes. And the activation of this mechanism was just approved a few days ago. So that's also something that is of importance. Next Generation EU obviously is one point that is going to be relevant. But in parallel to this, there are also important other files that are under discussion. So for instance, the anti-money laundering scheme, where so far the EU framework is based on directives, so less stringent, and now the EU basically wants to take a step forward and potentially establish a new authority or some form of new mechanism to fight against anti-money laundering within the European Union. Another key is that of digital currencies. The European Central Bank is looking a digital euro. Capital Markets Union, I've just mentioned, the issue of green financing, so the taxonomy of the green bonds that may be bought or should be fostered or not, etc. So this is an ongoing discussion. And also, I think bottom line is that there will be discussions in terms of the Stability and Growth Pact. So those rules in terms of deficits in the member state, because it will be very difficult to maintain these rules after the economic downturn provoked by the pandemic. And there has already been a call by French President Macron, for instance, that those rules should be suspended at least temporarily. And this is, again, going to have a whole impact on the whole European semester cycle, but also, for instance, on the role of independent fiscal institutions. So those fiscal councils that were created in response to the previous crisis with a view to providing independent information and to assessing the budgetary plans presented by governments primarily. And their role has been changed with the pandemic crisis, and they're also with the view to the activation of the different EU mechanisms. So what does that mean for Parliament? What can we expect to happen for Parliament? So, well, the reform of the European semester quite clearly will affect Parliament, and also the fact that the European semester will be used for other priorities is going to be key, such as, for instance, the protection of health, the Green Deal, but also the rule of law mechanism are beyond the sole economic aspects, also going to be aspects of interest. And also the next question is that of the creation of new EU entities. So, for instance, in terms of anti-money laundering, I was just telling you that there is the idea that potentially we will have a new agency or a new body in charge of this. So eventually this will have relevance for Parliament. In terms of national Parliament's participation within this specific policy area, there has been an ongoing discussion within the framework of COSAC in terms of how it should continue to function, how interparliamentary cooperation should continue to function. And this is likely to be a topic that will remain of importance and may have potential spillover on interparliamentary cooperation in this specific framework. And the comments that we've just heard before also illustrate this. And there are also, reflections on the need to increase interparliamentary cooperation in relation to the banking union, which has been, as I said before, fairly in existence. And some have also called for more interparliamentary cooperation with regards to the different budgets. So because the EU budget eventually depends on or is linked to the budget of the member states. So there has been some calls for this type of cooperation to be enhanced. Now, at the individual level, what can we expect to be issues deserving attention? So, well, the first off, the participation of national parliaments in this revamped, even more important European semester, and also the impact that it will have on national budgetary procedures, as well as, like I said before, the question of interparliamentary cooperation and how to best exchange information and best practices. The other point of importance is, how decisions are being made at the EU level. So I mentioned before this question of, the duality or the complexity of the decision-making procedures with formal and informal areas, the Eurogroup in certain instances playing a role that akin of that of the council, but also the perhaps a more difficult point here in these times is that all of the meetings are held remotely, which arguably makes for a more difficult parliamentary participation at European and also at national level. And the last point, as I mentioned before, before I open the floor to questions, is how can parliaments best make use of the independent expertise of independent fiscal institutions? So independent fiscal institutions are, in many member states, actually in the majority of them, a recent innovation from the previous crisis. So member states were forced to create independent fiscal institutions in charge of assessing the, all other things, the economic, the economic data that is basically being used by governments when they draft the budget. And then they will provide an assessment and say whether it's likely that it's going to be respected or not. In some parliaments, but not all of them, also have their own parliamentary budget office. And these have been also institutions, so these independent fiscal institutions have been important in activating certain, mechanisms to check, if a member state is not necessarily, strictly speaking, sticking to what it should be doing in terms of economic trajectory, whether there are certain circumstances that will excuse this deviation from the objective that had been set, etc. But in a context in which, the rules at EU level are going to be or have been already relaxed, so what role can those independent fiscal institutions play? And some of them have already been used, for instance, to budget or to assess the programs that have been adopted by parliaments and governments to counter the pandemic, for instance. So they have used their economic expertise to help decision makers, legislators, make the decisions that are as sound as possible. So these are questions that are under the table and on the table, excuse me. And I think I will stop here and just open the floor for questions, comments, and perhaps starting with Bruno. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Diane. Now, I think Bruno, our permanent representative in Brussels, has some comments on this issue. Bruno, please.
Yes, can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so good morning once again. First of all, I have to say it was, as always, a great pleasure to listen to Diane because she's one of the academics who better understands this national parliament's business. So I think that's it was very good for all of us and very insightful, especially because she addressed a very complex policy field, as she mentioned, because all this economic governance, economic coordination has evolved in the past few years at a very fast pace and with some institutional approaches which are quite unique, as Diane mentioned. For instance, Article 13 conference comes from an intergovernmental treaty, not from the treaties itself. So this is something that national parliaments have to adapt to. And Diane also mentioned the role that national parliaments can play individually at the national level and collectively. And this is, I think, the main question that should concern us in general as staff of national parliaments, but also projecting this topic for our presidency, because if we want to be relevant in the discussions that we somehow steer during our parliamentary dimension, we need to be very targeted in the topics that we want to discuss and put on our agenda. Just coming back to two points which were raised before on the lack of ownership, it's challenging for all national parliaments, even for the Bundestag, as you might comment afterwards, coming to the Constitutional Court decision. It's challenging for different reasons, and to be very blunt, no one gets reelected for asking sharp questions to the single supervisory mechanism. No one cares. It's not on the news. It matters to gain capacity, acquire knowledge, to then be able, for instance, in the Portuguese case, in our, I lost track of how many committees of inquiry we had about banks already. It's relevant for that. So we should also tone down the expectations about what members actually are engaged in when it comes to this kind of scrutiny. I have a couple of questions, maybe to provoke a bit the debate. The first question is, if Diane, if you were sitting in our chairs and organizing Article 13 conference next year, first question, which formats would you choose? Because I agree that the format, and please don't quote me outside this huge virtual and physical room, the format that exists does not help this capacity building and this development of ownership of parliamentarians, EP and national parliamentarians, because it's a lengthy exercise and it's not connected. Because one of the main issues is that in all national parliaments and also in the European Parliament, the European semester exercise is this sort of umbrella under which all parliamentary committees can interact, because it's about labor, it's about budget, it's about EU affairs in general, it's about climate transition, it's about health nowadays, it's about resilience, to use the new buzzword. So this is quite challenging, and if you don't provide a linkage between all these dimensions, it's quite challenging. So which format would you organize if you were the host? Secondly, if you would have to choose two topics out of all of these ones that you mentioned, because we are now in the process of drafting our agendas and the topics, and this training is also targeted for that. If you would have to choose two topics, so that then we can negotiate with the European Parliament, which ones would you choose? For instance, would you mainstream a little bit more the climate, digital, and health dimensions? This is just an idea. And finally, because I know that you are an expert in this German Constitutional Court issues that also relate to monetary policy and also relate to the European semester, it's been a while since the ruling. It was supposed to happen something by August. So my question is, do you know something more about what has happened, if the Bundestag has adopted something or not? Thank you very much and congratulations. It was very, very useful.
Should I react straight away?
Yes, go ahead, Anne.
Okay, thank you. Well, thanks very much, Bruno, for interesting and challenging questions. So first off, in terms of formats, I think you've correctly, well, I would differentiate your question, if I may, in two sub-questions. The first one being the format in itself, and the second one being the question of the membership and the participation of who participates actually in those interparliamentary conferences. In terms of format, and again, I'll use the privilege that you've used before not to be quoted on what I'm going to be saying, but having attended a few of those interparliamentary conferences, I find it a little bit shocking, for instance, that even physically, you know, you would have a distance between the speakers and the audience. And that's not going to foster dialogue. So I think, you know, if I were in your chair right now, I would start off by saying, you know, what are the formats even physically that are going to foster more discussion? And I'm not saying, you know, you should completely remove any, you know, speeches or any interventions from a commissioner, because that's also what's attractive. You were talking about attractiveness for parliamentarians. Well, going to Brussels and being able to directly interact collectively with the commissioner is not something that many parliaments are getting, at least to my knowledge, in their capitals. So, you know, I would make a mix between formats that will allow for exchanges, really. So, you know, not necessarily around the table, but nowadays also with Zoom, perhaps it reduces these differences, and formats that are going to be tailored more at, you know, gaining information, so to say, or knowledge in terms of what the plans of the Commission are, or of the European Parliament or the Council for this matter, so the presidency. And also I would try and, you know, make the speakers speak to one another and not a series of speeches necessarily. And another aspect, I think, but I realize, of course, it's very difficult to organize from a practical point of view, is I would try and keep a space for targeted debates on current issues. I mean, we're at a time where every week you check the Commission's website and you have a new initiative or you have a new development. And, of course, like I was saying, I understand you need to close your program sometime in advance, but I would try and build in flexibility wherever possible in terms of the debates among parliamentarians, because they will be happy to go and discuss, for instance, now, I don't know, the implementation of SURE or this sort of, you know, recent development. So that's to the format. In terms of the challenge that you very correctly highlight in terms of the membership, indeed, the additional issue you may have is that while you have different interparliamentary conferences running in parallel, and you also have different rules applicable to memberships of the different committees in the different national parliaments. So I know that some of them, for instance, in the European Affairs Committees are composed of representatives of the different sectoral committees. So that would mean that, for instance, COSAC is also a good forum to discuss this. But in other national parliaments, well, dual membership in different committees and in the European Affairs Committees is not established or is not mandatory. So that makes it more difficult for you, but that's not an answer to your question. Perhaps one thing to consider is, well, to discuss, and I'm just thinking now, as Shaw would say in French, so in hot, reacting to your question immediately, but perhaps one idea would be to use the European semester and its different dimensions in the different interparliamentary conferences where applicable, and not solely, you know, in the Article 13 conference, which is supposed to be the place for a European semester, but maybe, you know, you can, dedicate more the Article 13 conference to an exchange, for instance, on the governance in EMU. What does it mean for the EMU framework that we've had all of these changes being approved in response to the COVID crisis, in terms of the role of the Eurogroup, in terms of the role of the ECB, in terms of the reshaping and change, significant change in the functioning of the ESM treaty, which now doesn't have conditionality, for instance. So these are aspects that I think would be interesting to discuss in the European semester, the Article 13 conference and the others in the other forums, starting from COSAC. Now that leads me to the last question, which again is not an easy question, about vice and the Bundesverfassungsgericht. It is my understanding, but I again to be checked, that now the Bundesbank, so the ECB, has channeled the information via the Bundesbank, and this has now been settled. It doesn't change anything to the fact that the reasoning of the Bundesverfassungsgericht and its interpretation of EU law, at best can be the object of criticism. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. I don't see anyone else. So, Edward, perhaps you want to say the last words?
Well, I think since we're exactly on time yet again, it's great. First of all, thanks, Diane. That was exactly, I think, the scope and the kind of thing that we were hoping, and I think you covered very well the range of issues and addressed the interparliamentary and the national parliamentary dimensions. So thank you very much indeed for that. I don't think I propose to take any more time, though. I'd like to respect this. And I think the Bruno's questions from Brussels were very helpful in wrapping things up and prompting some final reflections that apply the issues to the direct concerns of your parliamentary dimension, which is a good point to stop. Yeah. So thanks very much, Diane.
Yeah, we'll do a 15-minute break and resume by 10:45. Thank you.
Online to also indicate whether they're already back from their coffee break and ready to go, either in the chat through a thumbs up. All right, great. I see a couple of people indicating that they're ready to go. Possibly a few are still coming back shortly.
All right, I think we are about ready for our second session. Just as a reminder, our trio of presidencies, that include Germany, Portugal, and Slovenia, decided to promote three high-level conferences on migration and asylum, so this next topic will be of particular interest to our colleagues in the Committee of Constitutional Affairs, Rights, Freedoms, and Guarantees. I'll ask Edward to make a quick presentation of our next speaker. And
good. Thank you, Joao. Indeed, it's a great pleasure to be joined by another colleague from APA who works like Igor yesterday in Luxembourg, Petra, Janae, and she has broad experience related to migration, both from the scientific and academic point of view, but also from the practice. She was involved directly in the Hungarian presidency and can bring her institutional perspective, I think, also to bear on the different institutional roles. And I think we're looking forward to her presentation about the ongoing debates, migration pact, and so on, and look forward. So thank you very much, Petra, for joining us, and I hand over to you.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to address you and I'm particularly enthusiastic about the new modalities of the parliamentary dimension of the EU presidencies, which certainly wasn't the case in 2011 during the Hungarian presidency. So let me share my screen and let me turn to the topic that we are to discuss today. That is the new EU Pact on Migration and Asylum. What I intend to do is the following. First, I would like to set the scene and talk about the various upheavals that led the EU to do and redo and further redo its asylum and migration regime. I would like to address specifically the agenda for migration and the situation. Then I would specifically in detail address the new EU Pact on Migration and Asylum. And at a later part of our discussion, I would like to tackle some of the events and issues for your presidency. And I think we can take the discussion from there in identifying those items which will be, could be, or should be relevant for the presidency semester of Portugal. As a disclaimer, I must say that any discussion today on asylum and migration within the EU is very complex. So basically, when we talk, we were talking about the new EU Pact, immediately our framework of reference will be a three-layered regime. The current acquis that was adopted basically right after the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty, so the existing law. The second layer will be the 2016 packages that the European Commission proposed. And that we, and what we will see is that most of these proposals, almost all of these proposals, have been stuck in the annals of the co-decision procedure between the European Parliament and the Council. And no matter how much progress the Parliament made, basically the Council in 2018, went back on most of the political agreements that were near reach with regard to the asylum packages. So there is the current legislative impasse on the basis of the 2016 proposals. And the third level of discussion, or the third layer of reference, is everything what would like to basically break and cut the Gordian knot, that is the current proposals and the current packages of the European Commission based on the wider context of and the wider framework of the EU Pact and the legislative proposals which have already been tabled by the Commission with the Pact, and the ones which we are still awaiting, and the Commission pledged to table them in shortly. So this is why any discussion on the EU Pact is complex, because references are constantly made to how the existing law should be changed, how these changes couldn't be manifested in ever since 2016, and how our how the current proposals basically would like to untangle these differences between and among member states. And of course, it goes without saying that asylum and migration are extremely controversial, politically speaking. So whatever is said and done policy setting wise or legislative drafting wise, it all happens in a very sensitive political context. So if just a way of a reminder, I would like to recall that the EU has been fostering common European asylum system ever since the entry into force of the Amsterdam Treaty. The first phase of legislation was passed between 2003 and 2005, followed by a second phase between 2010 and 2013. So these are the two big legislative movements that have taken place in the past. And the current repository of EU asylum acquis is basically the qualification directive, denoting who gets international protection. Secondly, which member state is responsible to process the asylum claim. That's the so-called Dublin regulation, and it's very...
Sorry to interrupt you, Petra. Could I ask you to perhaps share your share full screen of your PowerPoint presentation? Sorry, thank you very much.
Okay, so if I may go back, the second bit of the EU asylum acquis is the Dublin regulation, basically denoting which member state is responsible. That's the most controversial piece of the ever-existing asylum regime. Third, hand-in-hand with the Dublin regulation, we have the Eurodoc regulation, which is about the finger and palm printing of asylum seekers. We have a procedures directive, and we have a reception conditions directive. And the last bit is a regulation on the European Asylum Support Agency. So these are the legal instruments which always are referred to. However, EU asylum and migration has other fields. The EU developed a comprehensive visa policy. The EU has obviously the entirety of the Schengen regime, that's the border management and border control regime. It is this where the EU can signal or report the biggest success, that is the recent success in the sense of replacing the Frontex regulation and replacing the regulation with a more robust law enforcement agency, the so-called European Border and Coast Guard agency. The EU has harmonized rules on irregular migration with regard to the expulsion procedures. That's the so-called return directive. And in the field of legal migration, the EU adopted tiny sectoral pieces of legislation, and we'll come back to that because this is a pretty important part in the future to create legal channels, additional legal channels for third country nationals coming to the EU. So this is these are the traditional areas of EU asylum and migration. And what happened in 2015 and 16 is that Europe had to confront a situation where almost suddenly the so-called first, the number of the so-called first asylum applicants, so those who apply for international protection for the first EU, has suddenly quadrupled. This posed a very distinct stress on the entire common European asylum regime, and basically brought to the surface all the pitfalls of the pre-existing ever since the peak of the crisis, as it is denoted, basically that is 2015 and 2016, we see a certain decline in the number of first applicants. However, numbers are still high and a lot higher as numbers that we have seen a decade ago. And not only numbers are high, the shared experience of this within the member states is very different since the allocation of applications. So member states who are primarily affected and targeted by the high number of applicants is absolutely unequal. And this is a systematic deficiency of the current system. So basically geographical location determines which member state will be exposed to migratory pressures or not. Therefore, one of the key aspects, key considerations through which the current system is to be reformed is to share the burden faced by mostly coastal and member states with land borders on the external borders, who constantly face migratory pressures from the Mediterranean and from the Balkan region. So this was the 2015 and 2016 crisis, which triggered a completely new overhaul or a complete reconsideration of the asylum and partially the immigration acquis. The EU's responses have been put into two categories. First, there have been a number of operational responses, and I would like to highlight them because they were crucial in reducing immediately the number of first applicants. So these were the search and rescue operations undertaken by the member states and Frontex together. The temporary relocation project, heightened attention to resettlement, and the undertaking of member states governments to carry out resettlement activities, the funding provided by the EU, the so-called hotspots approach, whereby EU agencies and member states have certain designated locations, especially in Italy and Greece, to increase capacities in registering applicants, etc. The very well-known EU-Turkey declaration involving high-level cooperation, the EU Facility Fund for Turkey, and the undertaking of Turkey to elevate the humanitarian circumstances in refugee camps in Turkey, the one-for-one arrangement of Syrian asylum seekers and refugees. So that was probably a crucial instrument, which initially was foreseen to last for 3 years. And the keeping this arrangement with Turkey seems to be currently a priority, although obviously a more structured form should be sought for. And the Commission started to adopt these implementation packages, basically reporting about all the implementation details in this area. So these were the so-called operative responses at the time. Now our interest truly lies with the policy and legislative responses. Now, the immediate response from the side of the Commission was to relaunch a discussion on migration by the adoption of the so-called European Agenda on Migration, and we will study this instrument in detail in a minute. And the Commission, and we must admit with light speed, adopted two reform packages of the existing regulation. Now, I would like to just underline that we are in 2016 when the Commission proposes these new legal instruments, legislative instruments, at a moment when there is the crisis which is still sort of ongoing, and there is this huge expectation that something has to be done and the law has to be changed. However, member states have just transposed or not, but meant just transpose and pick up and apply the second phase of the European Union's Common European Asylum System. You recall that the second phase, which was adopted after the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty between 2009-2013, has just entered into force, has just geared up for application. So for the member states, the situation at the time was that there were the new rules. The new rules under the crisis were immediately labeled as unworkable, and the Commission proposed yet newer rules for discussion. The 2016 proposals, with all respect, completely lacked any understanding on how the second phase rules could have worked or would work or had worked. So the new 2016 package was written with having no idea about the workability of the rules and no evaluation exercises. The point of departure was that there is a crisis and the problems brought up by the crisis must be tackled through legislation. Now, we will talk about these instruments in detail, but let me just highlight that these legislative proposals contained the reform of the notorious Dublin Regulation, and this is the part which attracted most of the attention of the member states, because this is the piece which involves a compulsory relocation scheme. And this is the piece which contains the so-called bottleneck approach, meaning that so there are the member states who are exposed to migratory pressures and the asylum seekers arrive there, and it is for these member states to basically filter applicants, and those who have a view to a merit-based asylum procedure would be relocated, but the rest is to be returned by the member state of first entry. And the element in this proposal or this idea or this regulatory solution in basically involves two items which were absolutely hotly debated in the Council and in the European Council and by member states. First, that basically countries of first arrival, and mostly Italy and Malta and Greece, were appalled that they would need to deal with so many asylum seekers and filter and register them. The next step was the relocation aspect, where mostly Central European member states, the Visegrad group in principle, completely opposed the idea of being relocated or having to relocate any asylum seekers and complete the procedures in those countries. So the impasse was immediate, I would say, with regard to the compulsory relocation scheme, no matter that the proposal promised that this would be the biggest solidarity measure ever, and this would be the way how the burden of dealing with asylum seekers would be shared. The other elements of the packages included the upgrading of the Eurodoc database by extending the persons who are to be fingerprinted, basically including children, and irregular migrants were to be fingerprinted as well, and Eurodoc would be used to immigration purposes as well. The European Asylum Support Office's mandate was to be broadened, and a new European Asylum Agency was proposed. Now, one of the boldest pieces of the package at that time was the qualification regulation and the procedures regulation. So I immediately would like to call your attention to the change of the legal form. So with the, through these proposals, the Commission did nothing else but proposed regulation, so unification of the acquis instead of directives to be harmonized with harmonization rules to be transposed at home. The Commission went bold and said, like, okay, no more transposition. We had enough infringement procedures. We had enough member states not transposing properly. So from now on, these will be regulations. And the biggest changes were made in the context of the procedures regulation, where basically the so-called secondary moves, so when asylum seekers who should be staying in the country which is deciding their asylum application change their mind and move to another member state and try their chances there. Now, the new procedures regulation was to propose sanctioning of such moves. There was a new reception directive proposed and a recast of the then current reception directive and a novelty of the package was and is the so-called resettlement regulation, which creates a permanent European resettlement scheme whereby member states through a European mechanism are permanently invited according to quotas to resettle directly from third countries people, persons who are in need of international protection. So this was the big policy and legislative response that took place almost immediately during and after the crisis, so basically 2015-2016. This was the basis of these proposals was the so-called European Agenda on Migration 2015. Now, this Agenda on Migration followed the traditional way of thinking about migration management that we have seen, that we have always seen when the EU framed asylum and migration. So pillar number one, reducing incentives for irregular migration. Pillar two, strengthening borders. Pillar three, providing international protection. And pillar four, basically providing legal channels. However, in real, what happened is that no matter that the Commission was quite successful in making the member states to accept an emergency scheme for relocation and did propose a permanent scheme for relocation as well, besides the asylum part of the European Agenda on Migration, the other pillars were not followed up with robust legislative proposals and policy reconsiderations. So neither with regards to irregular migration nor with regard to legal migration, the European Agenda on Migration didn't really propose anything new. It used the well-known catch-all words. It didn't propose anything truly novel. So it didn't offer anything which could have been seen a real game changer. Where the Commission did propose robust novelties was related to asylum, as I mentioned, through the 2016 package, and basically the strengthening of the Schengen system with a strengthened role of Frontex. So in retrospective, my humble reading or assessment of the European agenda on migration would be that at the time it made a distinct effort, so it was a nice try, but it wasn't enough of a wake-up call because the irregular migration and the legal migration aspects of the entire migration management word remained underscored. What we see in the legislative, what we see with regard to the legislative proposals made by the Commission in 2016 and onwards, what we see is that with regard to the asylum package, the European Parliament very quickly pulled its forces together and came up with committee draft opinions and committee opinions. The reporters delivered their job, and they were ready to negotiate. And presidency after presidency struggled with pulling together at least a fragile general approach in council so that at least had a mandate to talk to the European Parliament. And then everything stopped by the end of 2018, where even partial political agreements were wished to be renegotiated by the council. So what we see today, basically the legacy of the previous parliamentary cycle, is this absolute legislative impasse, a complete stalemate, and that nothing has been adopted, and not one element of these proposals managed to pass the race. So why is it so? Procedurally speaking, the European Parliament early realized and early understood that the asylum package must be dealt as a whole, so as a package. And no matter that these are separate legislative proposals, given the very high degree of the interconnectivity of the and the interconnection of the issues, it's not possible to make agreements on individual proposals. The second, more substantive reason is that basically the Council got stuck, especially discussions evolving around the compulsory relocation scheme led to a situation that in the Council, the working party on asylum concentrated on trying to iron out technical matters, but otherwise the big questions, the big ultimate questions, were left to statement, basically heads of states and governments to discuss and come to a conclusion at the level of the European Council, and we all know that no conclusion, no definite compromise was reached there. So how to overcome this situation? The new Commission when the both the body and the presidency was inaugurated, pledged to overcome this situation, and this is what is manifested in the 2020 EU Pact on migration and asylum. So what the Commission is proposing is the following. And of course we hear the same old catch-all phrases, a more fair system, a better system, a more efficient system, a system which provides solidarity and burden sharing, etc. However, besides the rhetoric, one has to immediately see that the current proposal is much more comprehensive in the sense of accommodating new ideas and new policies with regard to irregular migration and legal migration. So these are the two aspects which I mentioned that were heavily underscored by the European Agenda on Migration. And the current EU Pact is not only richer, but much more concrete and does come with new ideas and provides new overtures for both the European Union and for the member states. So that's a very, I think, in that respect, a positive tick can be given, and the EU pact should be praised. On the other hand, and here comes the more difficult part, that it's a very difficult and complex situation that the pact basically inherited. And the purpose of the pact is to offer a fresh start, a restart, not to forget everything that has been done previously, not to swipe everything off the table, but somehow build on compromises, understandings that have been achieved so far with regard to certain matters, build on them. However, it has to provide. It has to break the impasse by admitting that which were those items in the 2016 package which just didn't work out for the EU member states, and admit that those will not be not find acceptance and support, especially with regard to the member states. And chiefly the item here is that the suggested reform of the Dublin regulation is simply not feasible. It's it will not possible to have a deal over that suggestion. So something else has to be put on the table. So these would be my introductory remarks with regard to the EU Pact. And now I would like to go through the big chapters as, of the Pact where our discussion in relation to the asylum part will be more detailed, given that this is part of this, this is the part of the Pact which was followed up immediately with concrete legislative proposals. So meaning that on the same day that the pact came out, the Commission tabled all these legislative proposals as well. With regard to Schengen, with regard to international partnerships, with regard to crisis management, with regard to legal migration, we are still awaiting the concrete legislative proposals, hence our discussion is restricted to the pact itself, and we are still awaiting the incumbent legislative proposals. So the first part of the act, which is which was immediately complemented with legislative proposals, is the part on asylum, where the Commission pledges to relaunch the process. And in that regard, a number of proposals have been submitted, namely the asylum, the proposal on screening, the amended proposal on procedures, an amended proposal on Eurodac, a new asylum and migration management regulation, and a crisis and force measure regulation. So these are this is the asylum related legislative package that is on the table, and the policy setting of these proposals is the EU pact. So what does the European Commission propose concretely? And now I have the unsolvable or very difficult task of presenting you 300 pages in a couple of minutes. But let me just highlight that the most important new item with regard to the asylum package is a new concept, which is screening at the border. So the European Commission proposes that instead of the current situation where asylum applicants enter territory and await the result of their asylum procedure. Today, this is the situation today. This should be replaced with this screening process whereby immediately after, upon arrival, applicants and everybody who all third country nationals who have crossed the external border without authorization and those who have been rescued on sea will immediately undergo screening without the right to enter the territory. So they will remain at the border, I should also say almost on the border, and first undergo checks. In order, and these checks include health checks, security checks, database entries to the database, so registration, fingerprinting, security checks involving a quick check on national security risks, debriefing, which will be followed up on with a decision either to immediately expel or start the asylum procedure. And if the decision is to start the asylum procedure, there will be a decision whether that procedure should be fast-tracked or not. So this is a bold move because through this proposal or proposing this modality, the European Commission accepts reality that most member states keep, like member states with external borders keep most of the asylum seekers on the border up until taking a decision whether they have a prima facie chance to be eligible for international protection. Of course, from a human rights perspective, this is highly contentious because through this measure, the right to the access to the procedure and right to access the procedure through entering the territory is pretty much curtailed. And between the lines, one cannot forget the question that how it's going to be secured that third country nationals will stay around the border. Well, this will only be feasible or possible through detention. And this is a big headache to put persons in detention immediately upon arrival when not knowing anything about their possible recognition and obviously not knowing about themselves and anything concretely about themselves individually. This is not a criminal procedure, so detention doesn't seem to be justified and it will be a problem. So this is the screening at the border that the Commission proposes. With regard to asylum procedures, the Commission hopes to keep everything in place that was proposed in the 2016 proposal. What it adds is a robust border procedure, so a quick procedure on the border in order to filter immediately false applications and ineligible persons. And this is the fast-tracking that I mentioned. Now, the key element that the Commission proposes is basically the obligation on the sides of the member states to merge, in a way, the decision to expel and the refusal of the asylum application. So these two administrative decisions should be one single decision, whereby any and all decision on turning down an asylum application will necessarily have to have provision on expulsion and an order on expulsion. Previously, or I would say currently, these are essentially two different procedures. Once the asylum procedure closes, the immigration procedure opens. And what the Commission proposes is to merge those and immediately expel those who are not eligible for international protection. The Eurodac regulation remains the 2016 proposals remains in place according to the Commission. Slight changes are suggested at this stage to further expand the use of personal data. Now, a central part of the European European Commission's package is the saying goodbye, in a way, to the Dublin regulation. So, as I said, the 2016 proposals sought to share responsibility in a way that the asylum applicants arrive in the member states who are on the external borders, and those applicants whose application will have merits were relocated, were hoped to be relocated or suggested to be relocated to the other member states, the so-called core member states, who have no external borders. Now, this whole idea is now dropped, and basically the 2020 scheme says that there should be a menu of solidarity measures. So instead of this whole relocation mechanism, should be various ways and modalities how member states should pay solidarity towards each other. And member states can choose from this, where relocation is only one possibility. Other possibilities for the member states will be to undertake return sponsorship, so helping the other member states to expel and to return third country nationals to their country of origin or to their transit country. To participate in capacity building in those member states who are in need. And also, besides relocating asylum seekers, it will be possible to relocate recognized refugees. It is through this menu that the Commission hopes to tame the Visegrad countries, basically, not to have to compulsory participate in relocation, but instead of relocation, they can show their solidarity or basically pay their solidarity through other measures. We have to see whether this will work or not, but this is what is offered. The last feature of the asylum package that I would like to mention is related to the crisis management aspect. So the Commission intends to ensure that crisis situations are better identified and better dealt with. With regard to identification A specific recommendation is also forms part of the package where an EU crisis management blueprint is proposed in order to be able and build the capacity to anticipate a crisis situation and not only just to respond and react to crisis situations. This is one element of the measures and suggestions. The other is to come up with a system whereby if there are mass influxes from third countries that member states will have the possibility to provide a protection status for third country nationals for a briefer period. And this proposal would replace a completely dormant EU legal instrument, the 2001 directive on temporary protection. Besides that, there is this division between crisis situations with regard to situations of force majeure on the one hand, and on the other hand, crisis situations. Situations of force majeure are situations where basically it's through unforeseen external circumstances that sudden events take place, which completely change the modalities of the migration management, such as the current COVID crisis. Whereas the crisis situation is described as a situation which is individually faced by a member state not being able to deal with the sudden arrival of very high number of asylum seekers. So briefly, again, this was a gallop. These are the proposals in relation to how to break the impasse with regard to the asylum package. And if you allow me, I would pause a moment for here and to see if you have specific questions regarding the asylum parts of the EU PAC. So I'm awaiting your questions regarding the...
Sure. I don't know if any of my colleagues from the Committee on Constitutional Affairs, Rights, Freedoms and Guarantees want to say something now, or do you want to wait until the end of the session?
As you prefer. We have some questions, but we can ask them now or at the end. Good morning.
Okay, so perhaps we can do so now.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, on behalf of the staff of the Committee on Constitutional Affairs, Rights, Freedoms and Guarantees, the Committee which, in first place, deals with migration issues in coordination with the European Affairs and the Foreign Affairs Committee. I would firstly like to thank you for your very interesting presentation, still going on. This is a very valuable source of knowledge for us. The new pact has been long expected, and it is a very recent good news for the EU. As a national parliament, we are now looking forward to proceeding to the national scrutiny of the package of legislative and non-legislative instruments. We are glad that the focus will not be on stopping migration, but instead on new ways of managing it. This is why the new asylum and migration management regulation is especially important, not only from the point of view of the asylum applications, but especially concerning the mechanism for solidarity. This said, we would like to ask you some questions. First, do you believe this new package will be facing another legislative impasse, or are there new solutions that will enable the EU to go forward? Second, from a human rights point of view, what main challenges will these proposals face? And last, and although, as you stated, there is a strong interconnectivity of the proposals, concerning the new pact, what would be the main issues you think should be addressed in an interparliamentary meeting we will host during the presidency? Thank you in advance, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you very much for your kind words. Let me try to react to all the issues and questions you raised. So, but please correct me if I forget something. So first, you one of the, your questions was that whether this package will be more successful, whether what's the guarantee that this package will not suffer the same impasse that the previous packages. It's very difficult to answer this question because the stakes, I think, are very high. The way how the EU, I would love not to say couldn't tackle, but it's difficult to overcome this expression. So, I mean, the EU must tackle this task and must show results. And the last 4 years were about everything, but not results. So it has become a credibility issue. So that's why I think the stakes are very high and the expectations are very high. So and this is understood, I think, EU-wide. Now, what also caused, what caused the impasse of the previous legislative package in terms of procedure is that because we are talking about a shared competence between the EU and the member states, where this is an ordinary legislative procedure where there is a qualified majority vote in council. So there are many policy-based reasons why certain ideas couldn't fly. But when it comes to numbers, basically qualified majority couldn't be attained because. Even the and a great number of member states didn't like the packages from various points of views, and there will be always. And if you listen to the immediate reactions from the Visegrad countries, they immediately rejected the EU pact and this legislative pact. So there will always be a number of member states who will never like certain ideas, such as relocation. The bigger question is that what do you do with the rest of the club who wants to break the impasse? So this is where I think should both the so-called northern and southern member states be put on board with the refinements proposed by the Commission, maybe this impasse could be broken, and maybe the proposals could become successful. So, bluntly saying, if you just if you can narrow down the non-believers and countries with constant discontent to a very fixed little number, you are already at the right on the right track. Your second question, I think, related to human rights. Now, with regard to the with the asylum package, human rights groups and those who give voice to certain concerns are aware about the following. The current situation is to be replaced. Why? Because we have laws which are partially applicable and sometimes they are sporadically applied, and a lot of voluntary agreements and case-by-case solutions overwrite legal rules. And this cannot be maintained. So there is a clear sense of wanting to have a set of regulatory regime, a regulatory regime which is at place and which is applied and works, instead of the current situation where we have rules, but it seems that they are losing their authority. So I think human rights groups say what they are saying in understanding that the current situation, that most things that the Commission proposes would be better than the current situation. What I already mentioned about the screening and border procedures regarding to detention, regarding to curtail to access to procedures and the right to enter to territory to receive protection, I think these will be constantly challenged by human rights groups, and at the end of the day, should the proposals be adopted with that content, it will cause problems on various levels under the EU and in the Strasbourg as well, in the context of litigation before the European Court of Human Rights. So therefore, it is in the EU's very own interest to accommodate these human rights concerns and to ensure that its own asylum regime is in line with human rights consideration in order to protect the integrity and authority of this legislation. Now, further human rights concerns, the data protection aspects of the Eurodac regulation are problematic. The European Data Protection Supervisor highlighted this a number of times. And the current 2020 proposal only enlarges data usage and enlarges access to data. Basically, Eurodoc will become an all-encompassing finger and palm print and photo and personal data database that can be accessed by all immigration and asylum authorities and law enforcement authorities. So there will be a constant exposure to data protection challenges. Just to mention something on the positive side as well, the Reception Conventions Directive, which is not at the centerpiece at the current 2020 proposal. Why? Because this was one instrument where adoption was really at the doorstep, but it couldn't happen because of the package approach. So basically, there is political agreement over the 2016 proposal on the Reception Conditions Directive. Now, that is a decent piece, and ensuring that asylum seekers awaiting for the asylum decision receive benefits. At a certain point, they can access labor market. Their healthcare needs are met. So the Reception Conditions Directive is on the positive side. So with regard to fundamental rights, these would be my initial reactions. From a presidency point of view, I would say the following. Of course, I think there is a decision as a national parliament in supporting the work of the European Parliament, whether you want to press on the legislative side or you want to deal with other issues which are not necessary, which do not necessarily take the form of a, or which are not channeled in legislative processes at the EU level. On the legislative side, basically as the pact itself asks, European Parliament and the national parliaments and the council have a range of ongoing proposals to conclude. So on the legislative side, you have a huge variety of topics that you can support or that where you can with regard to which you can decide that, yes, we want to make progress on. Now, given that these proposals were recently made, some of them, most of them have been made in 2016, there is a hope to renew the pre-existing political agreements, and then they could be adopted. I would say that if you are inclined to show results, obviously it comes naturally to go back to those where there are political agreement already, such as the Reception Conditions Directive, such as the European Asylum Support Office agency regulation. So those are like fruits low hanging that you can just pick, because there is already a high level of agreement, political agreement, and with this new impetus, there is a chance to have them adopted during your presidency semester. The others, the asylum and migration management regulation, the screening regulation, you can, if you are prone to show success and deliver, you will not be able to deliver a lot with regard to those instruments, because they have been just tabled. They are full of new ideas. Some of them are controversial. And, of course, you have to negotiate them. You have to start negotiating them. So you have to support the procedure. But I would be careful in identifying them as a presidency priority, because I'm not sure how much can you deliver. What I can see is that you can be successful in certain parts or certain subtopics where you engage in and you discuss that in a very thorough or a very comprehensive fashion, and that's your result. So these would be my suggestions when it comes to the proposals which are negotiated and are in the context of a legislative procedure. But the EU pact on asylum and migration, when it comes to asylum, has elements which are proposed by the Commission, but are not done and do not trigger legislative procedures, such as the three recommendations and one guideline that have been proposed by the Commission. So there is a recommendation on preparedness and crisis management, crisis blueprint, which I mentioned. There is a recommendation on resettlement. There is a recommendation on search and rescue operations. And there is this guidance on the private entities who do search and, sorry, that was the previous one. There is a guidance on the facilitation facilitators directive. So, as I said, these are three recommendations and one guideline, all inviting member states to reflect upon the ideas brought up in these respective soft law instruments. So you may want to identify one of those or more of those as a presidency priority, because they are soft law, you are not straitjacketed in the procedural framework of the legislative processes, and basically you can further the discussion and you can present them in a much more flexible way, and you can get through your message, should you have one, or you should wish to make one, by presidency conclusions, events, etc., etc. So I would be, and in terms of success rate or how rewarding this task could be, I would say that you can make your mark with regard to these items as well. Should that be the desire or the stance for you? So just to give you an example, there is this recommendation on private entities providing search and rescue on high seas. So this is the absolutely contested issue of NGO vessels providing search and rescue on the Mediterranean, basically pulling back and embarking at coastal EU member states, and then the NGO facing criminal prosecution for facilitating irregular entry. Now, this manifested in a great number of criminal procedures, human rights complaints, and it's a vexing issue because on the one hand, the coastal country, the coastal EU member state doesn't want very enthusiastic, nice NGOs to pull all these people and bring all these people on the shore and just multiply the number of asylum seekers. On the one hand, on the other hand, there is the absolutely humanitarian consideration that no one should perish on sea, and everybody and should be rescued. And if EU member state governmental facilities are not enough, then come the private facilities. So this is just an example that this is a very controversial issue. The Commission, for good reasons, didn't want to legislate on it or propose anything in the context of legislation, but it considers the topic important enough to make a regulation, to offer a recommendation on the basis you can work and you can carry the work on.
Thank you. I don't know if anyone in the room wishes to say something, or perhaps in chat.
In the chat, there are currently no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Then let me continue. On the slides, I try to highlight what is the very respective tasks of the Commission, the Council, the European Parliament and National Parliaments. So having said that, I would like to move the other big chapters. Given the passage of time, I try to speed up. But as I said, it is the asylum part which is the central piece of our discussion today, because this is the part of the EU pact which is supported by legislative proposals. Second chapter of the or second big part of the EU pact is flexibility and resilience, under this title, what we have is the items which I already mentioned in the context of asylum, the rewriting of the old Temporary Protection Directive and the crisis blueprint proposed by the European Commission, and the European Parliament and the Council are kindly asked to step up in adopting the new crisis instrument. So the third big part of the EU pact is, of course, Schengen. And what we see here is the following. And as I mentioned, let me again underline that this part of the EU pact still awaits the concrete legislative proposals to be made by the Commission. Now, Schengen and the interrelation between Schengen, the Schengen regime, and the EU asylum and migration regulatory regimes is simply crucial. and the 2016, 2015 and 2016 crisis very well show how the two regulatory regimes are interconnected and basically depend on each other. So you recall that there was a point where in 2016 the Schengen regime itself almost collapsed because of the internal border controls re-established by EU member states as a response to the migration crisis. So it's of utmost importance to have a well-managed Schengen regime which responds to the various challenges of the EU asylum and migration situation. So what the Commission says that it's going to rethink the European Integrated Border Management, which is the underlying concept of the Schengen regime, and will implement and propose and then implement a so-called multi-annual strategic policy and implementation cycle, meaning that planning and evaluating measures would go hand in hand in a cyclical fashion, which is not the situation now. The situation now is that we have the Schengen rules and then we have thematic Schengen evaluations led by the European Commission vis-a-vis certain member states. But this is not done in a cycle where basically results would immediately be built and would be immediately tackled by policy initiatives. There are two particular items which I would like to underline, which will emerge during the your presidency. First is the standing up of the European Border and Coast Guard Standing Corps with a capacity of 10,000 staff. So that is to take place as of 1st of January 2021. So this will be an event during the Portuguese presidency, and the ongoing work of the so-called interoperability of the large-scale information networks. This is the VIS regime, the entry-exit regime, Eurodac. Constant work will be going on with regard to this interconnectability of the currently existing IT databases. Another aspect of the Schengen regime is that the Commission will launch a common European approach to search and rescue, which is something new. Currently, or as of up until now, all these efforts were made on a voluntary and case-by-case basis. And the Commission promises to adopt recommendations on the one hand, but also practice guidelines in how these measures and efforts should look like. And of course, besides that, involving Frontex to provide technical support, et cetera. Now, with regard to the Schengen regime, strictly speaking, the Commission promises to launch a strategy on the future of Schengen and reworking of the current Schengen evaluation mechanism and provide a forum on Schengen. So basically what the Commission promises is a new opening of discussion how the Schengen area should look like after all these crises, because there are a number of rules in the Schengen Borders Code which need to be reconsidered. For example, with a view to the current pandemic, where what we saw is that where the Schengen borders code talks about a lot of things, but this public health aspect, for example, was completely missing from the ideas that were put together when the regulations was put together and when was it it was amended, and that those amendments were numerous. So basically the Commission proposes a relaunch of the thinking about the future of Schengen. The Schengen bit is a part which, if I may put it like that, I feel that the parliamentary dimension has to be the parliament dimension probably is slightly more difficult because there are so many technical aspects which relate to operational capacities and operational modalities that naturalize with law enforcement, and therefore the policy discussion absolutely rests on a very clear understanding of these very practical aspects. So this is the only slight or small comment which I would make. Now, the last item I would like to concentrate on is the international aspect of EU asylum and migration, and this is the part where the EU pact on migration is much, much stronger than the previous European agenda on migration on the one hand, and also this is the aspect in which I think that any presidency, and especially the Portuguese presidency, could make significant could make significant contributions. So it is the first time that the whole discourse in which the importance to reach out to our international partners is not only it takes the form of not only referring to the well-known items such as we need more readmission agreements, the EU shouldn't be draining, etc., etc., but the Commission proposes new ways on the one hand and designates a significant amount of attention and emphasis to this theme. So there is, I know it's only words, but I would like to just highlight that the amount of text that is devoted, that all these partnerships from the EU side should be seen as mutually beneficial. So the previous migration-related texts rather concentrated on what the EU benefits from this regulation, and yes, we have to offer something in exchange so that the third country would cooperate with the EU. So now the framing of these international cooperations is very different in the new text. The new text is different because it unmistakably concentrates on North Africa and the Western Balkans as key regions with which very close relationships need to be maintained. Now, with regard to readmission agreements and reintegration, the EU pact offers the possibility to connect better or link better readmission agreements to the visa policy of the EU. And this is something which basically already took place because the visa codes amendment has taken place and the joining of the visa policy has taken place. Therefore, the EU member states and EU institutions agreed that the visa policy of the EU towards those countries who do not perform their obligations on the basis of a readmission agreement, and those countries with whom the EU does not have a readmission agreement, and these countries don't want to sign a readmission agreement, now visa policies will reflect these stances. So, and this is very much reflected in the EU pact. There is a promise to have a future voluntary return and reintegration strategy. So this is an item that may trigger your attention. Also, the efforts with regard to resettlement, and also that it is for the first time that an EU policy document talks about community or private sponsorship. That is an institution or a modality through which private persons fund and support the integration of resettled persons and in the European Union. At the European Union level, we haven't seen any concrete proposal in this regard. This is a very well-known modality of resettlement and integration of third country nationals, for example, in Canada. Also, part of the acting together to deepen international partnerships is the so-called talent partnership idea, which is seen as an instrument or a framework through which labor shortages in the EU could be met with third country nationals coming from partner countries, third countries, on the basis of the cooperation of labor authorities, employers, trade unions, social partners, and of course the governments within the partnership. And this is would be, according to the current stage of the proposal, a comprehensive EU policy for the funding and support of the legal arrival of third country nationals to work in the EU coming from third countries. So here I would like just to highlight that it is with regard to international partnerships that a lot of efforts could be channeled in with regard to events, with regard to proposals. The EU Pact makes a specific case how to involve the High Representative and the European External Action Service in these efforts. And the last item where, as I mentioned already, the EU Pact should be celebrated relates to legal migration. And of course, the text starts with the typical or reoccurring admission that the EU needs labor force, the EU needs skilled labor, and it is not doing well in the global race to attract skilled labor force. So therefore, a number of new initiatives are made. First, the immediate adoption of the blue card would be important, which is also stuck in the legislative process, and which would provide a broader definition of highly skilled, not only making recourse to university degrees, but also making recourse to specific skills. So that will be one aspect, but the EU also proposes definite skills and talent package in which it proposes to create a talent pool of those who are looking for work and for those who are seeking a workforce to come to the EU and address labor shortages. The previously untouchable single permit directive and long-term residence directive are proposed to be revised. Again, I can't help myself saying that a year ago, the refit with regard to these instruments were closed, and the same, well, not entirely the same, but the Commission concluded that no revision is needed. Today, what we read is that revision is needed. But all this has to be seen as the Commission's effort to open up legal channels for third country nationals to come to the EU. And here, just let me make recourse to the well-known phenomenon that one of the reasons why the asylum realm is so overburdened, because a great number of applicants ultimately want to work in the EU, but since legal channels coming to the EU are so narrow, they basically opt for the asylum regime and try their chances there. Hence, asylum, the asylum regime is overburdened, and basically a lot of unfounded applications are need to be dealt with. And as I previously said, the legal migration aspect of the EU pact makes a strong case to change that, as opposed to the previous European agenda on migration. So, coming to the end of the presentation, I would open the floor for questions here. On the on this slide, I just mapped out around what events all these issues could be discussed, and you have the next slide in which I highlight some of the issues which can be considered or reflected upon as items to highlight in the migration and asylum-related presidency priorities. So I thank you for your attention, and I would pause here and await for your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Petra. I don't think we have any questions from the room, but I'd like to see if anyone in chat wishes to, use the, to take the floor on this issue. Seems not.
At the moment, I also don't see indeed any questions. I'm not sure if anyone has anything that they would like to ask Petra still. They're also, you're also welcome to unmute yourself if you want to ask a question. If not, I don't think there are any questions at the moment.
You have one more slide, I see. Do you want to comment that before
yes.
we go to the last round of contributions that are waiting to come, I think?
Yes, thank you very much, Edward. I just wanted to be very cautious about the time frame. That's why I stopped. So on this slide, I just highlight some of the issues that could be brought up by the presidency, by the Portuguese presidency, and especially the parliamentary dimension of the Portuguese presidency. Asylum we covered. I would turn to the Schengen item. Here, I think the general debate on the future of Schengen, which would be an aspect where the parliaments could contribute with. As I mentioned already, I just simply want to briefly repeat it. All the other aspects with regard to the interoperability of the IT's databases, the gearing up of the European border and coast guards are highly technical and I think are very difficult to frame as an accessible topic in which something new could be said or where impasse could be broken. Whereas with the discussion of the future of the Schengen regime, I think new ideas could be contributed with, and the whole framing of the discussion could be a possible choice. As I already mentioned, with regard to illegal migration, I think this is a topic where which could be played both under the EU area of freedom, security, justice. So in the home affairs path on the one hand, but also on the external relations path as well, because the EU pact proposes much stronger links to the international partners of the EU and has makes distinct emphasis on labor migration and opening up possibilities for third country nationals to come to work in the EU. And in the previous slide, I highlighted it, but obviously the EU-Africa summit would be one definite venue to achieve results in filling up all these instruments and concepts and proposals with actual content. With regard to irregular migration, well, this is a part where this is the repressive part, and it takes it's a decision whether to go down on that line and make it a priority, a presidency priority. Probably the humanitarian aspects of the voluntary return and reintegration strategy is an aspect that can be beneficially discussed in the context of national parliaments and with the participation of national parliaments. So it is that piece which I think could serve best as an item for discussion for the parliamentary dimension. So this is where I would wrap up. I'm available for questions if there are any.
Maria Teresa, you wish to?
Please.
Thank you, Petra. It's Maria Teresa. I'd just like to tell you that from the your presentation and the PowerPoints you presented to us, we can see that it was a lot of preparatory work, and we would like to thank you for that. It was indeed exactly as we wanted to be. So you showed us the state of the art of the several topics below migration and asylum, and you also share with us your views on which would be the focus for 2021. So thank you for this. I would just ask you whether you would be available if we need some further, I don't know, explanation, clarification while we are in our preparatory works, if we could reach you. That would be my question. And again, thank you for your work.
Thank you very much for your kind words. I would be delighted to follow up on any of the matters which have been presented, and I would be honored to work with you. Thank you very much.
Yes, Petra. I will also add that I had quite a few requests for questions, but as your presentation progressed, all doubts were cleared up. So that's why there were no questions at the end. And again, thank you for your insights on the new pact on migration and asylum. Thank you. We will then break for an hour and a half for lunch, and we will meet back here at 2 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you, Petra.
Thank you very much. Have a nice trip back. Bye-bye.